is Grossman v. South Shore. Mr. Eisenberg.
May it please the Court, my name is Richard Eisenberg. I am counsel for the appellant Catherine Grossman, who appeals here from dismissal of a Title VII claim and a Section 1983 claim alleging denial of equal protection of the law. Both claims allege that she was discriminated against in her employment as a guidance counselor by the South Shore School District on the basis of her religion, which is evangelical Christianity. She argues that there is sufficient circumstantial evidence for a jury to find that the district had the requisite discriminatory intent.
Mr. Eisenberg, I have a preliminary question for you, which is how clearly did you explain to the district court judge that you were proceeding under the so-called direct method of proof as opposed to the indirect method of proof?
You know, I'm tempted.
You're very critical of him for going off on McDonnell Douglas, and if you had very clearly said to him, no, it's the other, then that criticism would be warranted. But I just wonder, did you make that as clear to him as you now are making it?
You know, I would say that apparently I didn't make it clear enough, but as I recall the briefing in this case, we made it quite clear. We cited the same cases to the district judge as we've cited to this court. And we made clear that the burden that we were taking upon ourselves was, you know, not to shift the burden of going forward through some type of disparate impact or disparate treatment test, but rather we were asking him to we made it clear to him that we were asking the jury to infer from the evidence that the circumstantial evidence before the that we would put before it that there was discriminatory animus here in violation of both Title VII and the Equal Protection Clause. I'm not sure how much clearer we could have made that.
Well, so your evidence is what? What's the evidence that they were discriminating against?
This court has always recognized that.
Just answer the question. What is the evidence you're relying on?
There is a failure to follow normal procedures in this case, in that the district's own procedures set forth both in the teacher's agreement and the handbook provided that any deficiencies would be brought to her attention. No such deficiencies were.
Non-use of Form C and D?
Non-use of Form C and D being part of that. The superintendent of the district testified that that was the policy with respect to probationary teachers. Her supervisor, Mr. Grossman, testified that he followed it in every case, was aware of no case in which he didn't follow it. Therefore, if a teacher had deficiencies, he would tell that teacher there were deficiencies. None of that happened here.
Did he talk about when? Because, of course, she is told in the formal letter that comes to her here that, you know, we're finding deficiencies, we're not going to renew you. They never fire her, of course. They just don't renew. And then give her the opportunity of which she avails herself to appear before the board and all the rest of it. So one could think perhaps that was notice.
Well, I would argue instead that the procedural irregularities continue at that point. She's given the letter saying that she's not being renewed for failing to meet the district's expectation. She asks, why? I've been getting wonderful reviews for the entire period of time that I've been here. And they refuse to give her a reason. She announces her intent.
Do they have to give her a reason at that
point? You know, there's no legal requirement that they give her a reason other than their stated policy of being open with teachers and letting them know whether there is a deficiency. And in this case,
why would it violate the First Amendment if they fired her because they don't like teachers or guidance counselor, I guess, not a teacher. They don't like them throwing away their condom literature, and they don't like people who are, you know, asking students to pray with them. Why is that religious discrimination?
It wouldn't violate the First Amendment. It would violate Title VII in the Equal Protection Clause because although it's our position that the district could...
What other religious activities are going on in this school that they're tolerating?
The reason that it violates the Equal Protection Clause in Title VII is because a jury could infer from the record in this case that the problem is not what Mrs. Grossman did, but who she is.
I think it's what she did. I don't think they cared about her being Christian. They're all Christians.
No, I think that they didn't care about what she did because when she did those things, they didn't complain.
But why isn't it a reasonable time to accumulate
her? If they weren't bothered by these acts, then why did they fire her? They suddenly discovered she was a Christian?
They indicated, because we have departure from procedural irregularities. We have, as I alluded to, the fact that the reason
that...
No,
just answer my question. If they weren't bothered by the condom stuff and the prayers, then why is it that they decided to get rid of her?
They've indicated the ambiguous statements that were made in the course of her hearings indicated that they didn't like the things that she believed in, that there were philosophical differences.
And why couldn't that refer to her role as a guidance counselor? Why, in fact, on this record, can it refer only to her role as a guidance counselor who is either preaching abstinence only, and I use the word advisedly, or is taking a neutral position and passing out the condom literature and didn't throw the video away and the other things that she did. I don't see why, if they don't fire her for praying right off the bat, maybe they're perfectly happy that she's Christian.
The reason that I think that a jury could infer discriminatory animus is that there is nothing in the record to support, with respect to the belief in abstinence, that she was preaching abstinence.
What is it you think that caused them to fire her concretely?
I believe that she was fired because she came to be identified as a person who had particular religious...
You're so vague. I'm asking you, what are her views? What views did they attribute to her that then caused them to fire her? What did they think she believed?
They thought that she believed in abstinence only and wouldn't promote contraception, even though she never refused to do so. In fact, was never asked to do so. They felt that she was a person who believed that praying with students or that prayer as a response to the type of crises that these students faced was an appropriate response. Again, they could have told her not to do it. Perhaps they could have even fired her at the time that it happened. But the fact that they couldn't manage...
Then she certainly would be here with a lawsuit The
fact that they couldn't manage even a word of criticism
Here's the problem I have with your case. If they discovered that somebody... in the school, who never said anything or done anything, but they just discovered that some teacher believed in abstinence only because she belonged to some different Christian sect from the people running the school, and they fired her for that belief. Well, that I would understand. But as far as one can judge from the record, they didn't like the fact that she was acting in the school on her religious beliefs by discarding the condom literature and by praying with the students. And I don't see that can violate Title VII. I think a school is perfectly entitled to say, we don't want religious activities because, you know, that's a loser. We're going to have suits by atheists. We're going to have little sects appearing, wanting to do their own religious thing. It's trouble for us, so we can't tolerate it. So you have to show that, no, it isn't that. It's not her conduct. It's just that they inferred from the conduct that she belongs to a branch of Christianity that they disapprove of. That doesn't seem very plausible to me, and I don't see the evidence of that.
Again, I think that we have to recall that we're in the context of a motion for summary judgment. That interpretation of what the district did,
the way we think about these summary judgment appeals is, could a reasonable jury on this record have found that she was a victim of religious discrimination? And how would a reasonable jury be able to infer that it wasn't her conduct that led to her being fired? It was her holding a particular type of sectarian belief that the management of this school disapproves of.
My time has expired. I'd be happy to respond to that with the court's leave. I think that the reason that a jury could infer that is because at the time that these things happened, the district did nothing about them. They were informed of them. They had no criticism. They had no instruction to tell her to do something else.
What happened to cause them to change their mind?
You know, I don't know that it's her burden at this point to say what caused it.
What caused them, in your view, what caused them to change their mind?
I believe that, as Ms. Falk said, that there were philosophical differences that they associated.
What caused them to change their mind? As soon as she threw away the condom literature and began praying with students, then they would have inferred that she was, you know, evangelical Christian, let's say. But they didn't do anything. So if they did something later, it must be that something happened in that interim. So what happened, do you think?
I think that the best evidence that we have of what happened is the comments and the statements that they made, that they felt that there were philosophical differences.
Posner is saying is they already knew about those philosophical differences for some period of time. That fits into your earlier argument. So there's no triggering event is what you're essentially standing there saying. Nothing happened. All of a sudden, out of the blue, they just decide they're not going to renew her contract.
I can't read Ms. Falk and Mr. Gustafson.
You don't have any evidence that anything
happened. I can't read their minds to know precisely when it was that they identified this person as being someone with whom they were uncomfortable. I only know that the conduct that they complain about was very, very old and was not sufficiently severe for them to do anything about at the time.
Which they apparently should have, given the fact that her teaching certificate expired at the end of 2004.
Well, that's another issue, and there was sort of a misunderstanding that was shared by the district as to whether or not she had to do something in order to reinstate that certificate now, or whether or not it was actually good for 5 years. She has since completed. She had to go down to Milwaukee and take a course, and now that certificate has been extended. The only thing that we know is that the conduct was old, the conduct wasn't problematic at the time, and when they fired her in the wake of stellar performance reviews, they referred to what she believed in. And it seems to me that a jury is entitled to infer.
But of course that's ambiguous, because what she believed in could mean, probably did mean, believed in what is proper to do in a school, which is different from your innermost religious beliefs. Right?
But she had not, for a period of 2 years at least, and in the case of the condom literature and contraception, really ever engaged in any type of conduct that the district could have been concerned about. I think that there are more than one inference to be drawn here, but as this court has pointed out, the business of disambiguating, and I'm going to assume that's a word because it was in the opinion of the court, disambiguating ambiguities is for the trial court. It's not for summary judgment.
Mr. Eisenberg, is your position that this philosophical differences language contains within it potentially discriminatory intent? Is that
absolutely, because it.
Let me just flesh that out. So you think even with the dated incidents, as you speak of, that a reasonable jury could conclude from that broad statement that could house, that is philosophical difference, that could house a religious discriminatory intent, that linkage would be sufficient to get us there? I mean, isn't your case that she's an evangelical Christian, not accepted, apparently, in a community that may not be evangelical. And by the way, was that at all fleshed out by way of discovery?
There's testimony that that other people who were involved were also Christians.
No, I
think whether they believe precisely the same.
One of them was evangelical.
Lutheran. Yeah, let me just follow that through. Isn't that a critical link here to establish what type of community she was in, to see whether she was discriminated against?
I think that it goes to the way in which the jury will consider the evidence. I don't know that there's anything in the law which says that she can't have a claim if the people who are treating her on the basis of her religion, for whatever reason, not necessarily because they don't share it, but because they just think it will cause too much trouble to have a person around here like that. I think that they can infer the discriminatory intent from the reference to philosophical differences, coupled, as it was, by Ms. Falk on two occasions with the view that there's too much religion, coupled with the reference to promoting contraception, believing in abstinence, and taken in a context in which she had really done nothing to promote abstinence only. She had thrown out some old literature 2 years ago.
That's a weak part of your case. I have to say, I wouldn't stress that if I were you, because I, first of all, can't imagine how condom literature can be outdated. It's not a technology that's changed that much over the last 10 or 20 years. And I just wouldn't go with that part of your case.
Well, I think it's important. I think it's important because
she was in favor of abstinence. There were 6 or 7 pregnancies at the school. The only thing the record shows is they were concerned that she wasn't being even-handed about these various strategies.
But there was nothing in the record to indicate that she wasn't even-handed about these strategies.
I think the condom literature is a very bad strike against her.
The record is that there was nevertheless condom literature kept in the guidance office during her tenure year there. The record is that she never denied any student information on all the options. The record is that she was never refused to undertake any instruction with respect to abstinence or contraception.
This notice of non-renewal, you're bothered because this happened so much longer after the... this notice of non-renewal in February 2005, was this at the end of a probationary term?
It was at the end of a probationary term.
But then there's a difference between deciding not to fire her on the basis of these incidents, waiting until the time for renewal comes up, and then making a decision, which can be based on everything that happened during her term. And according, at least to their brief, there were a couple of other things besides the religious related. So doesn't that really dissipate the suspiciousness of the timing?
It doesn't, because the district's own policies and procedures and their testimony with respect to what they actually did and the testimony of Mr. Gustafson that he never failed to do it suggests that during this period of time leading up to the decision to renew or not renew, there was no conduct that they felt was sufficiently bothersome that they should even mention it.
I mean, two things. If she did something really dreadful, they would fire her. If it was more of a borderline case, they'd wait until her appointment was up and the issue of renewal arose, and then they'd decide whether to renew her. Presumably there's a different standard. You're more reluctant to fire a person than you are not to renew her contract.
That may be, but the policy was that any type of deficiency, any type of complaint, would be made known to the teacher.
Okay, that's your first point about procedural error. Okay, well, we'll have to move on now, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Aberg?
Good morning. I think the court has pointed out one of the main concerns that the school district has with respect to this case, as well as Ruth Falk and Mr. Gustafson, also defendants with the district, is that in my view, and I've argued this consistently, that there is no evidence pointing, whether you're talking about bits and pieces or whether you're talking about direct evidence that's in admission or whether you can add something together, you still have to have that point to something having to do with the fact that Ms. Grossman was a Christian.
But there's where, I mean, I think the strongest point Mr. Essenberg makes is that when people say these broad, vague things like philosophical differences, maybe that's an ambiguous statement, and obviously we don't, as he was putting it, disambiguate at the summary judgment stage. We allow juries to do that, and if a rational jury could think that meant we've decided to fire all of the evangelical Christians, even though that looks to me quite unlikely on this record, but that's not that might not be the test. I think that's the point where he's really going for it, and he's also saying that they were worried about getting sued under the Establishment Clause. They were worried about crossing a line to let religion too much into the schools, and maybe somebody stepped back at that renewal stage and said, oh my goodness, you know, she's prayed twice with students and she's chucking the condom literature and she's doing things, this is nothing but trouble in the future, let's not renew her.
Well, I think the philosophical differences doesn't really help the case that much because you're really looking at that as a moral view, at least the way that it's been presented.
Certainly, well, the question is it because they just don't like, maybe, you know, they've decided the next person whose philosophical differences are there is somebody of the Islamic faith and they just don't want Muslims in the school?
I think there
are places where you wouldn't want to, you know, where, of course, the Constitution prohibits you from doing that as well as the statute.
Well, I think in terms of this philosophical differences, what you're referring to is language which is used by Ms. Grossman from notes that she took at the time of the board meeting where she came in and she talked to the board and said, I would like to know how I'm not meeting your expectations. And the president said, well, we're only parents. We don't know. And she had excused Ms. Falk, who was the district administrator at the time, and Mr. Gustafson, who
is that like the superintendent, the district administrator?
Yes, superintendent is another word. District administrator is one of the words as well. But in terms of the statutory reference in Wisconsin, they use district administrator and superintendent. But
okay.
School districts still use that term. But the philosophical differences is something that was mentioned or was part of some notes that she had taken with respect.
Who is alleged to have made the comment, for use the words.
I don't know that anybody made the comment. It's something that she simply characterized as that.
Depositions in this case have not unfolded such a fact.
I don't know that there's anybody who has said that there was philosophical differences. It's simply a heading that Ms. Grossman used and put under that issues of abstinence and birth control.
But she didn't attribute it to either Ms. Falk or Mr. Gustafson?
I think Ms. Falk is the one that was concerned about it, and she talked to her before about it.
So Ms. Grossman supposedly writes this note down saying that Ms. Falk said that there were philosophical differences at the meeting.
Right. Okay. And in fact, in the brief, what I indicate is, and I was just getting it to it, where she had originally come in and she had asked Falk and Gustafson, who made the recommendation, she asked them to step out because she wanted to talk to the board in private. She had the right to do that. And so Falk and Gustafson leave, and they find out, okay, I'm going to have Falk and Gustafson come back and say what is the basis for their recommendation. So, in fact, that is what they do. They do come back in, and she says, how am I not meeting expectations? And that's when Ms. Falk, as the district administrator, said, well, what has concerned me has to do with separation of church and state. And that was the first words out of her mouth at that meeting.
How large a community is this, or how large a school district?
Well, Port Wing is a very, very small town.
And the school district is limited to that town?
And surrounding area. But if you know the geography of Wisconsin, it's a very small town in the south shore of Lake Superior between Duluth and Bayfield.
Oh, okay.
So it's a very, very small community.
So, like 1,000 people, could you just venture a guess?
I'm ashamed to say that. I mean, they're my client, but I really couldn't say it. But very, very small.
Okay.
Very, very small community. So, you know, as I pointed out in my brief, the questions that were made to Falk and Gustafson in front of the board went directly to what they believed about her work performance or her conduct on the job bothered them. And that's what they told them. And I think the thing that bothers me about the argument from Ms. Grossman is she seems to say that that is really pretext for discrimination. So, okay, you're talking about the fact that our concern of constitutionally with the Establishment Clause and what our obligation is to remain neutral with regard to religion, which is a real problem given some of the issues, especially the prayer issue. It's
hard to imagine it a problem up there.
Well,
who's going to bring a lawsuit? Are you going to have the atheists come up there and start suing right and left? That doesn't sound very plausible.
Well, perhaps not. And as the judge pointed out, in fact, Mr. Gustafson is an evangelical Lutheran and belongs to that church. But I think one of the other things that's bothered me about the arguments is the most I've ever heard about referencing Christian or evangelical Christian or the beliefs of that particular group is argument from Mr. Essenberg. And the most argument I've heard about it is today. Most of the stuff that we've been talking about has to do with religion generally, which goes to the idea or concern.
I don't understand, though, you're lumping together all Christians. I mean, there's a long history of discrimination by one Christian group against others, right? Catholics against Protestants, Protestants against Catholics, all that. So the fact that they're all Christians doesn't exclude the possibility that they discriminate against evangelical Christians.
No, I'm not saying that, but I don't think there's any proof in the record to suggest that there's a sectarian problem there. I think the reason that I bring it up is the issue of my concern as looking at it as a defense attorney for these school districts, and we represent a lot with my firm, is every time that you look at a separation of church and state issue and indicate that that is a concern, does that now become a per se violation of Title VII or 1983 because you're talking about that issue? We have an obligation as a school district to make sure that we do not violate those provisions, the Establishment Clause, with respect to the First Amendment rights of everybody. And I think the other thing that concerns me the most is the arguments that have been made here to justify prayer. I mean, they're still doing it now when it should be obvious that it was a problem. They tried to justify it initially with respect to the free exercise issue, which they had initially, that they tried to protect themselves she tried to protect herself by saying that. That was taken out. She dropped that part of it. But even now, before this court, she talks about the fact that the prayers were private. The prayers were done because she knew what the parents' religion was and they wouldn't mind. The parents didn't complain. She asked the students first before she prayed with them, and they said it was okay. And then talking about the fact that there was no notice from us as some kind of a way of justifying, well, it couldn't have been that bad. Well, it is that bad. And I think...
But you, Mr. Aberg, the school didn't move with dispatch on this issue. If you say there's a sensitivity, as there must be with school districts, to this the religion issue in schools, it does seem that they didn't move too quickly.
Well, and there's a little bit of a distinction there, because you have to look at the fact that the person who was the immediate supervisor was Mr. Gustafson. Now, Mr. Gustafson is an evangelical Lutheran. Ms. Falk also knew about it, but she knew about it later. And it may have not been as big an issue for him. Maybe he was even somewhat supportive of it. I don't know. But, that's something to look at. But I think Judge Posner hit it right on the head in terms of how I'm looking at it. What changed between now and then?
Yeah,
they didn't take any disciplinary action against her at the time.
No, I appreciate it. But you raise at the time she has her hearing, then it surfaces again by we're concerned about church-state, religion in the school, right?
It is.
So what, has it been lingering in the mind of the supervisor all that time?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
I don't either, but I'm just trying to see what a jury could do. In other words, you have these front-end events, and they happen, and no action despite school board alleged sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Then at the end, is it a relation back to those comments by Ms. Falk?
Ms. Falk, I think, was the one who was most concerned about. But I think the point, though, is you have to still have the bits and pieces of circumstantial evidence to point to discrimination because she's a Christian, not because of what she did in the school. And that seems to be, I mean, the response in front of the board was all with respect is, what did I do? Well, they told her what she did. And exactly as Judge Posner said, when you go from a probationary status, as she was going under the collective bargaining agreement, she was going to go to a just cause standard, so she's no longer going to be an at-will probationary employee. Now she's going to have a just cause standard. They have to make a decision. In fact, I think in the deposition, Mr. Gustafson called it the million-dollar decision. Is this a person that we want to have? Because once they get protection under the collective bargaining agreement and you have to have just cause to remove them, it's going to be a lot more difficult if you have issues. So,
okay, thank you. But we'll have to move on and to our last case. So thank you also to Mr.
Thank you, Jason.